This is Fresh Air. A prison may seem like an unlikely place to teach aerobics. In 1987, Rodessa Jones was hired by the California Arts Council as an aerobics and movement instructor for women awaiting sentencing at the San Francisco City Jail. Jones soon found out that she'd never win them over with exercise alone, so she decided to turn aerobics into a stand-up routine. She started talking about herself as she went through the exercises. They listened, they moved a little, and after a couple of weeks, they started talking too. She's been working with women in and out of jail ever since, creating theater pieces. Her one-woman show, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, is based on the stories these women told her. I asked what it was like when she first arrived at the jail.
The seventh floor in the city jail in San Francisco is the holding tank, where you have women who haven't gone to trial yet, women who are coming down off of drugs, coming down off of incredible domestic trauma, sometimes murder, sometimes the murder of their own children due to a cocaine phantasmagoric trip. So this was the gang, and I felt like I'd been dropped into another world.
Were you scared at all about being there?
Scared? Nuts. I was more scared of the clinging doors and the people with the keys and the guns than I was the inmates themselves. But I was afraid of my inability. I thought, well, can I do anything here? Because there are women looking at me like, well, okay, what are you going to show us that we don't already know? Or who are you, and how are you going to manipulate us? You know, so immediately I ran up against this kind of stone wall or soulless people, as someone said yesterday, a lot of deadness in the eyes. But I proceeded to the gym with about 40 women who were made to go with me. And I realized the very first day that, no, this isn't going to work. They're not interested in aerobics at all. But I proceeded to really talk about myself and my life and my struggles. And soon I developed a following. People would come to the gym to watch and listen to this crazy gym teacher, as they called me. And I started talking about their lives. I'd find out who was in jail for what. And there were lots of prostitutes at this particular time. So I started talking about empowerment through physicality. I'd look at somebody and say, you're a prostitute with that body? I said, now, girl, look, check this out. And these women got into me coming from a place where they were versus coming from some lofty place telling them where they shouldn't be or how they should get out of this place. But I dealt with where they were. And it was about empowerment of women, even in jail. I mean, wherever you are, let's deal with what you got and see how we can make it better. So I had this little group that was learning all the routines that I was creating. And the older women were saying, well, do we have to move? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you have to move in a certain way, but you do get to talk. And I started devising games based on improvisational theater techniques.
One of the things that you've said about these women is what they seem to have in common, and what seemed to be the reason that many of them were in prison was because of love.
Love, yeah. We're all,
I mean, loving women, the wrong guy.
Yeah, but you know, as women, I think we can all say, I mean, at some point in your life, there's a psychological prison that we're all in, because women who love too much, women who are constantly obsessed with love, well, in jail, you run into it, boom. It's like concentrated. Looking for love in all the wrong places, it's so real. It's just, you know, when you start to talk to people about, well, why are you here? First memory is usually a boy. When you're talking with women about their first offense, it usually has something to do with the man that they're involved with, or for the man. They, you know, either robbing, stealing, or even getting into drugs has a lot to do with wanting to keep that love, or what you think love is. Yes, it was definitely a part of the problem.
and it seems the way you describe it, it's a destructive love. I mean, it doesn't seem to have a lot to do with self-love. Yeah. It has to do with proving oneself to a guy. I mean, whether he's even a prostitute.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that what makes you, me, us women who, quote, have sidestepped this incredible trap is that, well, I grew up during the 60s, so I have a certain politic, you know, and now my population, the women that I meet inside, they're young. Like I said, 19. They've been doing drugs since they were 9 years old. The only power they ever felt was that came with having somebody care, love about them, or having a certain kind of control, even sexual abuse, where you learn very early that if I let Uncle Frankie touch me, he'll give me $5. Then later, this man comes along, looks at you and goes, nice, nice goods, convinces you that, oh, baby, you're so fine, and then you're convinced to go out on the street and sell your body because he loves you and because daddy needs the money, and this is how you prove you love daddy. And daddy also convinces you that there's nobody else but daddy.
Tell us about the title. I love the title. I think it just, it's so kind of hearty. Big Butt Girls and Hard-Headed Women.
Well, when I first went in, the first week or so, sitting inside one morning, waiting for my group to get to be gathered, there was this incredible woman, about 6'3", 6'4", oh, maybe 200 pounds, but not flab, power, muscle, black, like black velvet. And they were chaining her up to take her to prison. And I'm watching all of this, and in my little naive way, I said to her, she passed me, I said, take care of yourself, be safe. And she just turned and looked at me, and she said, girl, don't worry about it. And she went marching off, and the way she, from the back, the shoulders and the butt, and it was moving, and it's up and down, and it was like she had an army with her. She was taking her army with her. And, you know, Joni Mitchell, I think, has a great song called I'm a Great Cook and I'm Sitting on My Groceries. You know, it's like, you know, on the street. And in an African-American culture, you're constantly told about the, you know, the possibility of your great past. You know, it's like as you walk by, as you're groomed and as a girl coming into your own sexual reality, the hips, your body, the butt is a prideful thing to have a big butt. As I've grown older, the white dancers that I grew up with, now they look at me and they go, I'm going to the gym because I'm going to get buns like yours. And so the big butt was that. But the negative side of it was that my father would constantly say to us, sit your big butt down. You know, you ain't grown. Don't be so hard-headed. And sitting in jail, looking at these women, you know, and the diet is so bad. It's so bad that everybody is huge. Everybody gains a lot of weight. And what might have once been a buxom, round, voluptuous figure becomes this voluminous thing. And at the same time, the butts, people spend a lot of time expressing, saying things with their behinds. You know, I mean, things that they couldn't say to the guards, or if they were feeling a bit dangerous, that was a way to throw your butt.
My guest is performance artist Rodessa Jones. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with performance artist Rodessa Jones. She has a one-woman show, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, drawn from her experiences teaching aerobics at the San Francisco City Jail. Tell us a little bit about your family. You grew up in Florida. Your parents were migrant workers.
Yes.
So you obviously had a very mobile or transient childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Did you follow them, or did you also work on the farms with them?
Yeah, I grew up learning about work. Real work. I mean, the moving of the earth, the pulling and the straining, the lifting. At the same time, growing to have an incredible love for the earth, for my parents, because I worked alongside them, understanding what it was to feed us. That was 12 of us.
Oh, and how old were you when you started working?
I started working. Well, you start working when you're about. When you're five, you have to take care of the garden around the house. And if there are babies, you have to take care of babies. By the time you're 10, you're helping your mother cook the food that feeds the camp. And, of course, then you go on to the field with your parents. And you do the things like go back and pick up the potatoes that we're going to take home for us, learning to count the bags. Then by the time you're 12, 13, you actually have a row. You have a basket. You're out there pushing right along. And your money is important. This isn't fun pin money. This goes into the family pot. It is part of what feeds and sustains the family.
And you were one of 12 children.
Yes, I'm the eighth child.
Your family was poor.
Yes.
No doubt about it.
Yes.
But you also have a brother that's a performance artist.
Guilty Jones.
Yourself.
Yeah, dancer, choreographer.
Were your parents interested in the arts, and did they somehow then instill, did they even beyond the poverty of their lives, be able to instill this appreciation of art?
Well, you know, I think it stems from you have to laugh to keep from crying. We spent a lot of time entertaining each other, telling stories. My father played mandolin. I have an uncle who, when he was a young man, he played in Ruth Brown's band. He's a banjo player. My mother was a gospel singer when she was much younger. And these things were just a part of the air. Because at the same time, you're taught that all colored folks sing and dance. So you don't want to do that. You want a basic a good education so that you can go out and get a real job and don't repeat this life that my parents saw as very hard. Now, the other side of that was the romance of the migratory trek in the 40s and the 50s was that there were camps. So there were always talent shows. There were baseball games. There were barbecues. And so we grew up seeing these people who would work hard all week in the dirt. And they'd be, you know, scrubbing to make those few pennies. But on the weekend, you got another look at the dreams deferred. People who could really sing, people who could really tell jokes, the acrobats, the magicians, they were all there on the camps too, even the cooks. I mean, there were pie contests. That was the best barbecue sauce. So there was this constant feeling of being on, performing, and we were encouraged. I mean, we didn't have a television until 1958. And with 12 brothers and sisters, we wrote scripts, we did songs, we wrote music. And the other side of that was my mother was to raise 12 children. She was incredibly like a mama bear. And we were fairly oppressed and repressed in a lot of ways. So when you grow up and you get away, you just explode.
You also worked for a while in a nude dancing club at Pico Rama. You were a peep show dancer. Now, was this literally to make money?
Yes. Yes, I
could you make good money?
I made, this was 1978, 79. I could make $100 a night. Which wasn't bad because it was under the table. You were just handed the money every night. My daughter was going to a private school in Marin County. Her father had just stopped giving me any money, which was my impetus. I had to go out and get a job. I was getting $370-some a month from welfare. So at that time, it really, really padded my income. And yes, I did it and kept the check, kept my welfare checked as well. Yeah.
Did you have any embarrassment about being naked? I assume most of the men in the most people in the club were men, although it was run by lesbians. Is that right?
Yeah,
that's a great twist, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was quite eye opening for me. It inspired me to make a performance. I thought everything was so the opposite of what we'd been raised to believe it was. It was very boring work.
Is there anything sexual about it for you as a performer in a nude club?
It's empowering when you realize that men will pay to look at a naked woman. And I was endowed with a great body, tight tush, great long legs, you know. But sexual in the sense of feeling female-ish or a woman on a certain level, no. But that was power and being, it was more like being a deity or a goddess. Those are the kinds of images I would play with, you know, sitting. Because half of the job was that you sat in a glass booth and men would put coins in and the window would open and they'd get to talk to you behind this glass.
So you would sort of come on with sort of velvety, seductive words?
Well, you didn't do anything because most men don't have any idea what the, you know, I mean, that was rare. It was very rare and few times when somebody would come along and that was an erotic exchange or... Eroticism in the artistic or intellectual way that we know it, the Kama Sutra, that wasn't there. There's a lot of woman hating in the world, you know, and the men who frequent these places really hate women.
And the women that work there, do they really hate men? I mean, is this a way of taunting men?
I think the lesbians or the women who sort of knew why they were there for the money could hate men, but I think. Women, we're far more generous. I think even the lesbians that worked there, it would have been too much to hate them. Taunting them, teasing them was another thing, you know. I mean, because it's really strange when we're raised in a society to believe that men are supposed to be running the world when, you know, and all you gotta do is drop your trowel and you got these people drooling all over glass windows. I mean, it's like for lots of dollars. I mean, really. And a lot of men, this was their sex life. I mean, something's wrong here.
Yeah. We unfortunately just have about a minute left, but I'm wondering whether this work at a nude club helped you as a performance artist.
Yes.
I mean in terms of your effect on an audience.
Oh, yes. I mean, and on top of that, it was like the racism that I ran into. Even as a nude woman, all of a sudden it was like, wait a minute, what's going on here when we can't all even be equal when we have our clothes off? I mean, I was a great-looking, I mean, I was 28, 29 years old. I was a great-looking woman, and still there would be men who would say, you know, you black bee this, and, you know, I don't want to look at you. And I knew that I was a hot-looking girl. And all of a sudden this was happening, and even amongst the women, there was sometimes this kind of racist competition, you know, assuming if I'm blonde, of course I'm the hottest one here. And here we all are stuck in this really tawdry, gross, stuck, sick little place, groveling around like a bunch of guppies or something, and these people, we're going to compete with each other, and there's going to be racist overtones even there. That was, for me, a place to start writing down what is going on, what do men and women expect from each other.
Performance artist Rodessa Jones will perform her one-woman show, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, in Boston on June 5th, 6th, and 7th. This is Fresh Air.